So today is Thursday, November 7th. We're going to start with a review of cerebrospinal fluid and circulation. Let me take you back to this picture, and we're going to start in your course pack. I'm on page 111. Some of you may be 110. So I'd like to start with what cerebrospinal fluid is, and it's actually partly what's found in your blood, minus a few major ingredients. So we have blood flow that goes through your brain, but we don't necessarily want everything in your blood to have contact with your brain. So we take some key components out of your blood and allow that fluid to circulate through your brain and your spinal cord. So the components of blood that we don't want circulating through every part of your brain and spinal cord are blood cells and some of those proteins. We certainly don't want viruses or bacteria circulating. So we will squeeze out things like fluids, glucose, oxygen we certainly want to transport, but we will also pick up waste products and have that join into the circulation. So the place where we squeeze this blood plasma out of the blood circulation is at these little tiny knot-like capillaries called choroid plexuses. And so in this picture, you can see the ependymal cells with cilia help to put that CSF out into circulation. So you can lay completely still, you know, and your CSF will circulate. CSF flow does not depend on your mobility. It simply depends on these ependymal cells creating a current to make all that fluid flow. So if we take a look at your brain, let's get a different picture there. We will actually find a couple of main places for those choroid plexuses to be housed. One is here in this lateral ventricle area. And another is down here near the fourth ventricle, back there toward the cerebellum. We're just going to pick one of these as a starting point and watch how the CSF flows. So if we pick this lateral ventricle area here as our starting point, then we say that CSF flow begins here. Let me flip pictures. Whoops, backwards, go the wrong way. All right, and so we're actually in this neighborhood, you know, around these two ventricles here. We can put that CSF into circulation into these lateral ventricles, and they coil into each of our brain hemispheres. From there, the CSF will flow through a tiny hole between the ventricles called interventricular foramen. Literally translated, what is a foramen? It's a hole, and interventricular means in between the ventricles. So that's our next spot, and we're just going to drift downward. From there, we travel through a third ventricle, keep on coming down, we go through cerebral aqueduct. As we travel down, we are now in a diamond-shaped area near the cerebellum. It's called what? It is fourth ventricle, and we continue to drift downward inside the spinal cord. Now we're in that hole, that central canal. So from the side view over here, you can see that our lateral ventricles, you can see this deep part of the brain here. We'll talk about that a little later. And right here is that diamond-shaped fourth ventricle. And then again, here is that central canal. So you get a different feel for the layout when you look at the front view of the brain than when you look at the side view of the brain. I would pick one. I personally prefer the front view and then look at the picture and then recite the pathway as it goes down. And then I think a few times through it, you'll have the routine down pat. A little harder to see the pathway in the side view, but it works too for getting that flow pattern down pat. Let's see, I'm going back to, I gotta get these slides are in the wrong location. Let's go to this one. Okay, so here we go again. We are making CSF around this area here, this deep part of the brain. It flows, in this picture we can't see it, into those two lateral ventricles that kind of curl like horns almost into each of the two cerebral hemispheres. It then drifts down through a tiny hole called the interventricular foramen, and then into a third ventricle in this area right here. Where do we go next after that third ventricle? Aqueduct, good. It is a really tight, narrow passageway right there near the pons. And from there, the CSF flows downward into this diamond-shaped fourth ventricle, good. So from the fourth ventricle, where do we go next? Central canal. And of course, we travel all the way to the very end of the spinal cord, and the spinal cord terminates around which lumbar vertebrae? This is old stuff, L1 or L2. So spinal cord terminates there. We no longer have spinal cord, and that CSF drips out and now is in the outer area of the spinal column in an area that we call that arachnoid space or subarachnoid space. It's just a specific part of that arachnoid matter. So CSF flows back up toward the brain. It travels around the outside of the brain in that arachnoid space and eventually is reabsorbed into those big, large veins on the brain surface. We don't call them veins, we call them what? Sinuses, good. So not to be confused with these sinuses that produce mucus. These particular sinuses are just large veins, and it's their job to pick up that CSF from the circulation. So right here you see an arachnoid piece that sticks up into that dural sinus, and this blue surrounding here, that's the vein in the brain. It picks up that cerebrospinal fluid, and once we're back into the blood flow, this rejoins blood circulation. All right, so let's try it one more time from the top. So where does CSF get made within the brain? Choroid plexus, good. We pick the ones that are closest to the third ventricle area, and from there that CSF can flow over here into these lateral ventricles. As it drifts back toward this middle portion, we now pass through a tiny hole called interventricular foramen, that's it. And then we drift down toward another ventricle. This one's called third ventricle. We now pass through an aqueduct, it's called cerebral aqueduct, into which ventricle? Fourth one, good. Travel down into the central canal, and then let's get a different picture. We now travel back up on the outside surface in what layer, what matter? Arachnoid space, good. We travel up the spinal cord on the outside surface of the brain. And then where does this CSF get reabsorbed back into blood flow? Dural sinuses, good. And they're nothing more than large veins on the brain surface. A lot of them lay in the cracks and crevices. That longitudinal fissure and those transverse fissures will pick up that CSF. So what came from blood eventually goes back into the blood flow. So all this is a kind of a detour for us to take those glucose and oxygen and other nutrients out to that brain tissue. All right, so this listing here is actually on page 112, maybe 111 for some of you. So that is good for both a lecture essay on test 4 and a lab essay. So that's a good one to get credit for in both locations. Do y'all have any questions about that flow pattern? So you may wonder about lumbar taps. If someone happens to have a lumbar tap, we are actually taking a sample of that cerebrospinal fluid. We don't have to go all the way into the central canal, thankfully. We can actually select and sample that cerebrospinal fluid from outside the spinal cord. So into what layer are we sampling and pulling that CSF? Subarachnoid, good. So part of that arachnoid matter, that spiderweb-like layer, we can pull and sample out that CSF. Certainly easier than tapping into the brain. Likewise, epidurals work the very same way. We are still working on that subarachnoid space that's around that spinal cord, but instead of extracting out fluid for sampling or testing, we're actually injecting medicine. So, of course, we don't want to push too hard because if the needle inserting that medicine goes into the spinal cord, now we can damage spinal nerves or nerves that are running up and down in that spinal cord. So this is kind of the same concept, just inserting through one of those intervertebral discs a very tiny needle that gives that medicine to the spinal cord. I also wanted to mention this condition. It's called hydrocephaly or hydrocephalus. What happens to babies who have this condition? Yeah. They've got too much cerebrospinal fluid in their subarachnoid space or even inside the brain in those ventricles. What is the problem for a baby who has this condition? Can't hold their head up, yeah. So do you know around what age those fontanelles start to harden and make... Yeah, good. So by one, absolutely by two, those fontanelles have hardened, and so the brain has then nowhere to go. So babies actually have an advantage over the rest of us. Babies have very flexible fontanelles, so this fluid doesn't necessarily cause brain damage. The whole entire skull can swell with this excess fluid. Now, we certainly want to drain this off because it can cause pressure on the brain itself, or we can even see a permanent change in the shape of the skull, and the baby may have an enlarged skull. So we want to drain and pull this off so the skull goes back to its normal size. If someone after age two has excess cerebrospinal fluid, the skull is hardened, so we no longer have that flexibility in letting the brain and the skull expand in size. So you can see in this picture on the left, that's how those lateral ventricles should look there. There is that diamond-shaped fourth ventricle. And in the picture on the right, you'll notice, boy, that's a huge lake-sized area of ventricle space. It's now swollen with fluid. Also, take a look at the outer surface. There is some space between the brain and the skull on the normal picture on the left, but on the picture on the right, it looks like the brain is shoved right up against that skull, so not a lot of room there for the brain to actually expand. Because the skull is hard after age two, the brain can't expand with the skull and accommodate all this extra fluid. So this condition of hydrocephaly after age two can cause brain damage. In fact, if you crush this outer portion of the brain, that's where our conscious thoughts and processing occurs. And so someone may have permanent brain damage if that outer portion is actually crushed from all this extra fluid. So they can actually insert pumps that pull this fluid off of someone's brain. If someone has a recurring issue of having excess fluid on the brain, that pump should help to eject that fluid into the abdominal pelvic cavity. So, you know, it's certainly important not to let this go untreated. All right, so let's talk about blood-brain barrier. That should be about halfway down your page. I'm on 112. Some of y'all may be 111. So what does this sound like, a blood-brain barrier? Trying to keep the blood and the brain apart. That's exactly what it is, right? So why would you want to keep the blood and the brain separated from each other?
Pathogens.
Pathogens, right. So that could include what? Bacteria and viruses that can get into our brain's tissue. And we don't necessarily want everything in our bloodstream to have access to our brains. So yeah, this is exactly what it sounds like. It is a way to keep the blood and your brain separated from each other. So in this picture, you may recognize some tight junctions. What do they prevent from happening? Tight junctions don't let fluids travel between, okay? And also, we should have astrocytes here helping to form our blood-brain barrier. They're not shown in this picture, but you might recall they are spiderweb-like looking cells. They help to form, I think, Angela, you called it a firewall, which is a great way to describe this. They form a completely impenetrable barrier so that the capillaries traveling through the brain are not able to do much of an exchange with that surrounding brain tissue. So you'll notice here on your sheet, generally lipid-soluble substances can travel into the fluids of the brain. Those kinds of fatty molecules are about the only thing that can pass through this capillary or blood vessel layer, but not much else. So that means that, you know, water-based items, large items, pathogens, we should not be able to see those cross through that blood-brain barrier. Do you see any advantage to this? Bad stuff is kept out, right? Okay. Do you see any problems in terms of medications reaching your brain? What must the medication be able to do?
Fat-soluble,
exactly. So we have a really difficult time treating things that affect the brain because of this blood-brain barrier. And so that means that if you're really wanting the medication to be able to reach brain tissue, either you get it in that interstitial fluid that can get into these brain cells, and it has to be fat-soluble in that case. So, you know, we've got a wicked mess here. We've got a great barrier to problems, but we also have a barrier to solutions as well.
Let me point out to you in that paragraph about the blood-brain barrier, it says there, only the emetic or vomiting center in the medulla oblongata, and then secondly, the hypothalamus lack a blood-brain barrier. So most of the brain has this blood-brain barrier, but we do not have it over the medulla or the hypothalamus. And we'll talk about why that's important as we get to those parts later today. All right, that should do it for page 112. How about questions there? Okay, so the next few pages, you'll notice there's an upcoming page, then there's a chart on the next page, a practice page, and then there's a picture of the brain. So that's about the next four pages. I personally find that if you have a picture of the brain available to talk about when you're learning this stuff, it'll make learning it a whole lot easier. So I encourage you when you go home is to pull that picture back up instead of just looking at words. I think it'll stick a lot better for you. I'd like to start you off at the top of 113, maybe you've got 112 there, with four major brain regions. Okay, so what are those four major brain regions? Cerebrum, cerebellum, diencephalon, and brainstem. Okay, so cerebrum, cerebellum, diencephalon, and brainstem. Notice the diencephalon includes thalamus, hypothalamus, and pituitary gland. And then brainstem includes midbrain, pons, and medulla oblongata. So right there, that's a way for us to categorize all these brain parts. In this picture, the cerebrum is the wrinkly outer portion of your brain. It makes up what we oftentimes think of when we say the brain. And there's a lot of wrinkles here because our brains have to be small enough to fit into our skulls, and our skulls have to be small enough to be able to fit through a birthing canal. So all of this wrinkly outer portion here is actually driven by the size of a birthing canal. Because we walk upright, that birthing canal has to be smaller. If we walked on all fours, then our birthing canal would actually accommodate a bigger skull. So all of this is driven by the fact that we walk upright on two legs. So that wrinkliness there that we see on the cerebrum is all about increasing the surface area and making sure we have enough storage space for all these neurons to communicate. Okay, so let's go down below on the cerebrum. The lobes are listed next. You've got frontal, temporal, parietal, occipital, and then sometimes there's referred to an insula, which is a deep lobe to the cerebrum. So first of all, let's orient this thing. What I look for is the cerebellum back here, and it is on the back side or posterior side of your brain, so that helps me know where I'm at. So knowing that, the portion near the front then would be this pink region here, and that's the frontal lobe. Where would you find the temporal lobe? On the side, it's kind of near temporal bone, right? So you got frontal near the frontal bone, temporal near the temporal bone, parietal's near the parietal bone, and occipital lobe near the occipital bone. So that's great. That's nothing new for us then. So on this picture, frontal's kind of pink, temporal here on the sides, parietal, and then back here toward the back is occipital, and then the insula is actually a deep inner portion that includes this area here. So we mainly refer to those other four, frontal, parietal, temporal, and occipital. We don't often talk about that insula as a lobe. So you'll notice the functions of the cerebrum include everything from consciousness to perception, communication. This is where your conscious thoughts come from. This is where you sense the world around you. You actually feel things in this part of your brain. You will generate motor skills from the cerebrum as well. So anything that has to do with your conscious existence as a human being is going to come from that cerebrum. Let's talk about the white matter versus the gray matter in the cerebrum. All right, so thinking about the spinal cord, it looks like they didn't quite get the board washed off here from the other day. If you think about that spinal cord that we did on Tuesday, where's the white matter in the spinal cord? it's outside, right? And that gray H-colored stuff is on the inside. Thinking about that, take a look at the brain. This time, gray matter is on the outside and white matter is on the inside. So in fact, the brain is flip-flop reverse from what the spinal cord has. So gray matter makes up this cortex portion. That's the outermost 1/8 of an inch of your brain. And then a lot of what you see on the inside here is in fact gray matter. There are a few pockets of gray matter actually stuck here in, as islands among that white matter. We'll talk about those too. Okay, so let's talk a little more about that gray matter. So these hills and valleys on the brain surface have names. The hills that stick up on the cerebrum surface, they are called a gyrus. And if there's a small indentation, we call that a sulcus. And if you have a really deep indentation, we call it a fissure. So that would be like the longitudinal fissure between the two hemispheres, transverse fissure at the back. So most of what we see in terms of hills and valleys on the brain surface are just gyri and sulci. That's a weird word, right? So gyrate is a hill that sticks up. A sulcus is a groove that is indented down. I had a student many, many years ago, and she stopped class. She says, I got a way to tell this apart. She said, God is up, G, Satan is down, S, stuck. Okay, so if that works for you, great way to remember it. Gyrus is the hill that sticks up, and a sulcus is the groove that points down. Also, if you're sulking about something, you're down in the dumps, right? So that's another way to keep these two straight. Nonetheless, why are these here? Increased surface area, right? Want to have more space to be able to store those memories and thoughts and processes and whatnot. Okay, so you also have Brodmann's areas that are functional parts of your brain. We'll talk about some of these on the next page. You know, certain regions of your cerebral cortex have certain jobs, and we know where those are at for the most part. So we'll talk about those on the next page in just a moment. Before we head there, though, I would like to finish up this page with white matter. There are specific tracts of white matter inside your brain. Because I'm using the word tract, I am implying to you that I am in what part of our nervous system? Central, right. So these tracts are inside the brain. They are in the central nervous system. And there are three that we're going to talk about: association fibers, commissural fibers, and projection fibers. Okay, so let's talk about association fibers first. Association fibers run the length of a hemisphere, usually front to back. Could be back to front, okay? So what you see with your eyes is actually carried from the frontal part of your brain all the way to the occipital part of your brain along some optic nerves. They become tracts, and they, of course, end up back in your occipital lobe. So the way that information is carried is along these association fibers lengthwise of a hemisphere. Take a look at this bottom picture. Notice these particular fibers connect the two hemispheres. What should they be called? Yeah, they're commissural fibers. So, whereas association fibers run the length of a hemisphere, the commissural fibers connect the two hemispheres. They run from left hemisphere to right hemisphere and vice versa. Really interesting studies have been done where they have cut those commissural fibers, like the corpus callosum, and they have found that people can close one eye and point at a key on a table, but maybe not be able to say the word key, because that information has to travel back and forth between those two hemispheres. So really interesting stuff we've learned about maybe trying to stop seizures and how these fibers communicate between the left and the right. Also on this picture, notice these fibers that come and they flare up through the brain. And this piece down here is like the pons, and inside there is the thalamus. Do you recall what information is carried to the thalamus? Pain and temperature, good. So if you have cold feet, then that cold is carried up to the portion of your brain that it relays to by these projection fibers. So they carry from the deep part of your brain where the information comes in, and then it's relayed out to the surface portion by a projection fiber. So it's projected by one of those fibers. All of this is white matter. All of these are ways to fast track information to right parts of the brain. Okay, so to review, we've got associations running lengthwise. What do commissurals do? Left and right, they connect. And what do projection fibers do? Project, yeah. They send that information to the right part of the brain. So we'll talk more about these as we go through some pathways. All right, so that should take us down to the bottom of the page. Do y'all have any questions on that page? Okay, so there is a chart on page 114. There is a picture of the brain about a page or two over. I would encourage, if you've got a, I think most of you have a notebook where you can unclip, I would see if you could lay your picture out, and then we'll do the chart secondly. So we're going to be going through that chart and helping to label these lobes. Top part lobbed off there. So for reference, this piece at the back of the brain is the cerebellum. I'm going to go ahead and label that. That kind of gives me an idea of where I'm at. And of course, the rest of what we can see is just that wrinkly cerebrum. There is a groove back here. Not sure if you can see it that well in your picture, but it's a deep groove that divides your cerebrum from your cerebellum. That is a fissure. Should we call it transverse or longitudinal? It is transverse. That is it.
Good.
All right, so just for the sake of labeling stuff, why don't we pick out a gyrus and label that, and a sulcus. I'm going to come up here toward the front. And just pick out a groove. Of course, the groove is a sulcus, and a heel is a gyrus. So I am looking, if you've got page 116 with the brain picture on there, I am looking for a sulcus that's running close to the front, and it is right through here. Okay, so I'm looking for a groove somewhat near the front. That is actually a landmark, you might say. It's called a central sulcus. So I'm going to label that one next. So if you were to wear a headband or a crown, it would run a right around where that central sulcus is sitting. And the reason that's important to find is because what's in front of it is a lobe called what?
Frontal
lobe. Good. And the lobe behind it is called?
Parietal lobe, good.
And if we keep on coming toward the back, the lobe at the very back is called your? Good, occipital lobe. That leaves one. That leaves the temporal lobe, which is, of course, near the temporal bone on each side. Okay, so let's head back to that central sulcus for just a moment. In front of it, there's a heel of tissue, and behind it, there's a heel of tissue. Well, what's in front is going to be called the precentral gyrus. And of course, what's behind it is called the postcentral. Yeah, so pretty smart naming there. So just since we're in the habit here of labeling this picture, let me go ahead and help you label what each region does, and then we'll go through that in more detail. And I'm just going to use what's on page 114's chart to help me go through this labeling stuff. I'm going to jot down by postcentral gyrus and parietal lobe. These are both sensory. We'll talk about that in just a little more detail in a minute. Occipital lobe is also a special type of sensory. What should go there? That's vision. Temporal lobe, we're going to put two senses there. That is auditory or hearing and smell. And by the way, we'll put taste up here too with parietal lobe. Okay, and then one more thing we need to jot down in this frontal lobe area. We're going to have motor. So this isn't just any old motor. This is very specific type of motor skills. It's voluntary motor, so we may want to make a note of that. So we're actually looking at a picture of a left hemisphere in this real brain image. And because we're looking at a left hemisphere, I can also add for you the speech center for most people. Okay, and then we also have a couple of other specialized areas, but for most of us, we have speech on the left hemisphere, kind of in this general area between temporal parietal lobes as well. Are you so far so good? Okay, so we're gonna actually go through this again, and this time I'm gonna use the information on the chart. So if you have your picture handy, we can refer to what we've just done. Anybody still need this? Okay. All right, so let me start you off with voluntary motor information. When we're looking at the brain, this is yet again another left hemisphere that we're using. Anteriors toward this side and posterior back here. You may recognize this groove here between frontal and parietal lobes. What's it called? Good, that is central sulcus, and there's the heel of tissue on the anterior side, and that's called our precentral gyrus, right through there. So that precentral gyrus is home to voluntary motor control. When you think about moving your body parts, that voluntary motor control originates in the precentral gyrus. So, in this picture, you can see again, there's a premotor cortex and a primary motor cortex. Both of those are in the frontal lobe. One of them initiates and one of them coordinates the voluntary motor movements. But nonetheless, we know that motor control of voluntary movement comes from the frontal lobe, and it comes from that precentral gyrus right there in front of that central sulcus. This is a really cool picture. It's called a homunculus, and it's a map of that precentral gyrus on each of our hemispheres. And in this picture, you can see that it actually is found on both left and right hemispheres of the cerebrum. And a lot of surface area is devoted to places that you need a lot more fine-tuned motor skills, such as where? Yeah, hands. Look how big the face is. A lot of fine-tuned motor skills here, right? Okay, what does your elbow do? One thing, right? Nothing fascinating about that. So there's less surface area given to those joints that may not have a whole lot of fine-tuned motor skills. Interesting thing is what is occurring on the left side of your body is controlled by the right hemisphere of your brain. What do we call that control? Contralateral. Yep. So right hemisphere controls left side of your body and vice versa. Okay, so motor homunculus is found in the precentral gyrus, which lobe? Frontal lobe, right. So anybody who happens to be hit across, you know, the frontal lobe where that precentral gyrus is hit may be temporarily unable to move until they regain, you know, conscious control back over that area. I also want to mention subconscious control on your sheet for just a moment. These basal nuclei that are hidden deep inside our brains, some of these large gray areas here, they actually control subconscious motor control. You know, when you walk, your arms swing, and you really have to think about it if you want them to stop. But that subconscious swinging of your arms when you're walking is controlled by basal nuclei. So you're not really thinking about it. You don't really have, you know, much to do with your arms moving. Nonetheless, if someone walks and their arms don't swing, you ever notice that? Old people, never young people, right? So why do old people, the penguins, yeah, why do they walk like this? Why do their arms not swing? Watch this right now. Okay, so that's dopamine, and that is in those basal nuclei, these two dark spots right in here. So if you have low dopamine levels, you may have a disease called Parkinson's, and in that case, they may not swing their arms with their normal gait anymore. One good sign that there's something wrong with, you know, the dopamine levels and maybe the way their bodies work, yeah. So going back to this picture here for just a moment, I did want to mention this kind of ties into what we've already done in this class. If you decide that you're going to move some body part consciously, it comes from the opposite hemisphere, comes down through these descending tracts of your spinal cord. You may recognize right there we cross the gray commissure. And it's hard to see, but we're hitting one of these horns and we're coming out the ventral horn of the gray matter. Why that ventral horn? It's voluntary, right? Good. So come out that ventral horn. There we go, out that ventral root. So what we've just learned is now how the brain links up with the spinal cord, links up with a spinal nerve, heading to skeletal muscles. All that connection has to work for us to be able to move. So pretty interesting how this all links together. Let's talk about sensory info. And so this time we're not in the frontal lobe, we are in which lobe? Parietal lobe. And to be specific, we're in a very tight region here behind that central sulcus. This one's called the postcentral what?
Gyrus,
good. So that is where we house a primary sensory cortex. And I want to explain what it means to be a primary sensory cortex versus what it means to be an association area. Okay, so if somebody says, do you have a quarter that I can borrow? And if you carry change in your pocket, I don't know if anybody does that anymore, I don't. But if you had change in your pocket and you reached in without looking, you could probably feel around and find a quarter in there. Simply feeling those objects in your pocket, whether they're keys or coins or whatever, that information first has to come to the primary sensory cortex. If you have no sensation in your hand at all, you can't feel anything, you're not going to feel coins, keys, nothing in your pocket. You have no sensation whatsoever. So assuming that you can feel what's in your pocket, that information is then relayed over to an association area. That's when your brain says, that feels like a key, that's not a coin, that feels like a penny, that feels like a dime.
Digging around your purse,
exactly. So, you know, and I purposely used something where visual was not included because visual is another sense back at the back. This is just simply what you can tell by touch. So it's what we call somatic because it's what you touch and it's sensory. Primary is the first area we go to for receiving the information, and association is where you make sense of it. So if you have loss of feeling in an area, then you're just not going to be able to know what you're touching, right? Okay, so that is the difference between a primary and an association area, and all of our senses have a primary and an association area. All right, so let's talk about this. This is another homunculus. It is again mapped to the parts of your body that you can feel. And if anybody has problems with these mappings, people sometimes feel like they should not have that body part. You may have heard stories where somebody thinks they should amputate their leg because they don't feel like it should belong. And it's actually having to do with this homunculus mapping here. Ever heard of that? There are very rare cases where people may have brain damage or there may be something else that's happened in their brain, and then they suddenly decide that, you know, that arm or that leg shouldn't belong, and they have gone to great measures to cut off or remove that body part if they can't get it done through, you know, like proper medical services. So it's very rare, but if there's something wrong with the mapping, then people may have this disassociation with that body part. Even if you're born without the body parts, you still have a mapping to them. So if somebody's born with no arms or legs, their brain still has this mapping up there, as if it were to be part of their bodies. So back in, let's go back here for a moment. There we go, that's the picture. Here you can see that red is the motor and right next to it is the somatic sensory, meaning what you can touch and feel. Back in the 1960s, there were medications. I think I mentioned this to you all. Thalidomide was a drug given to moms with morning sickness in England. And unfortunately, it led to a lot of birth defects. I think it was something like 40 or something thousand babies were born that had birth defects, meaning no arms or no legs were attached to their bodies or very shortened arms or legs. So I might have mentioned to you that this was actually the start of our FDA, because our FDA says, I don't know if we want to give that to our moms that are, you know, pregnant, because it may cause problems. So that really started the research that goes into releasing a drug before it's given to the common population, which is good for us. So that is actually what causes the arms and legs not to form. And interestingly though, like I mentioned, the spinal cord is still mapped and so is the brain. Both are still mapped as if the body parts were there. So people may in fact have some sensation that there's a body part even though it was never formed. All right, so let's talk about the visual areas next. What lobe is this visual stuff housed in?
occipital, good, back of the brain, there is a primary visual cortex and there is an association area, just like we've been seeing. So where is vision first received in the occipital lobe? Primary means first, right? So vision that comes to your brain from your eyes is first received by the primary visual cortex. When you make sense of what you see, that's happening in a similar area in the occipital lobe called the association area. Okay, if you can't see at all, which one of these is probably the damaged area? Primary. If you can see but you don't understand what you're seeing because of maybe brain damage, it's the association area, right? So simply having vision means that your primary area works. Being able to interpret that vision is now, of course, the association area's job. So being able to distinguish between a chair and a table, those kinds of things, that's where we're going to use that association area for it. Interesting research done some years ago. If you take somebody who is born with no vision and you give them some of these glasses that actually hook into the back part of the brain, if they're living their life, maybe they're 20 years old and they've never had vision ever, what do you think they say when you give them these glasses allowing them to see? Yippee, this is great. It would be kind of confusing. Okay, so what do you think may never have properly developed? Yep. So if we can give them the vision, then that means that their primary cortex is probably okay. But you're right, because they were born with no vision and they never developed the ability to use that association area, they usually say, you know, hey, this is overwhelming. I don't want to do this. There actually was a case where they did this with the man in his 40s who had been born blind, and he said, nope, this is overwhelming. It's too much. Take it away. But they did the same experiment with a lady who was 3 years old when she lost her vision. She was in her 20s, and she thought, what?
Wow,
give me these glasses. So she was able to see the outline of her mom. She was able to see light and dark shadows. And so because her association area did have the opportunity to develop, she was on board with, yeah, let me have these things. So kind of an interesting thing about the way the brain works there. If you ever hope to have vision, you have to at least have the opportunity for that part of your brain to work. So weird how that part of your brain basically doesn't ever get activated if it's not used. Let's talk about the auditory area. What lobe is that housed in? Temporal, good. If you're deaf, where's the damage?
Primary
cortex, right. If you can hear but you don't understand what you're hearing,
association
area. So if you have an old man that lives at home alone and he hears noises outside, he might confuse chirping birds for somebody rummaging through his garbage can, right? So not knowing what those sounds are is that association area. We did talk about smell and taste. Let's pull those back up. Smell is olfaction, and it's in which lobe?
Temporal,
and taste is in parietal. Okay, so they happen to be in already lobes that we've talked about for other purposes, but nonetheless, they're not in the same lobe, but they are close by. You do have a primary cortex for each of these and a association area, so same setup as what we've seen all along for every other sense that we've got. I do want to mention something that's not written there. We will come to this on another page. But taste is the only sense that is not routed through your thalamus. You know, we mentioned that thalamus routes pain and temperature. Thalamus also routes every one of your senses, but not taste. It should be smell, not smell. Yeah, smell is the one that's not routed through your thalamus. And the reason I mention that is because it's kind of cool. What you smell now may remind you of something 5, 10, if you're old enough, 20 years ago, right? So that is hardwired into your smell cortex. Doesn't have to route through your thalamus. Kind of a weird thing there. Okay, looks like our next thing on the list is the general interpretive area. And again, we are looking at the left hemisphere of the cerebrum. you'll notice it kind of lays over parietal, occipital, and temporal lobes. And this general interpretive area is where your association areas relay what they've discovered. So you're not living by one sense alone. Your senses all come together in this general interpretive area, and there you have a more holistic experience. So it's, as the name implies, it's where we have a general interpretation of what we are sensing. And what is sent to that area then is then relayed to the hippocampus, some part we have not yet discussed, and that's where you make the memories of what you've interpreted and sensed. Let's see, the speech is the next area. And you'll notice the speech center is for most people housed in the left hemisphere. I've watched you guys take tests, and I think most of you are right-handed. Is anybody in here left-handed? Okay, so I'm curious. If you do talk on the telephone, do you prefer a certain ear?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Is it your right ear? Anybody, you prefer your left ear? Anybody not care which ear you use?
I don't care.
Some of you don't care.
I hear better out my left ear.
Hear better from your left ear, okay. Anybody absolutely have to have it up to one ear or the other when you talk on the telephone? I absolutely have to have it on my right ear. So I prefer that one. If I put it up to my left ear, I can hear, I can talk to you, but you know, I really feel more comfortable if it's up to my right ear. Is that how you feel? Okay, so what you've told me is where your speech center is housed. Most people who are right-handed will probably prefer their right ear for the telephone, and that means that the speech center is on the left hemisphere. Your speech center sounds like it's
left-handed until first grade.
Oh, interesting. So you prefer your left?
I'm left eye dominant.
Oh, okay, so there you go.
That's weird.
That is weird. So your speech center is probably on the right. Yeah. So did they break you and make you right with them?
My teacher was very old school. She was an old lady when I was in first grade, and she didn't have any left-handed scissors, and she forced me to learn to write right-handed.
Fascinating. So can you write with both hands now?
I broke my arm twice, broke my right arm twice. Right, left-handed, you can't always read it. I can read it.
Interesting. So fascinating how that was hardwired
in. And I
can
enter data entry, because where I sat at the bank, my adding machine, my computer, and all was set up left-handed. I can do data entry left-handed.
Because you're wired that way for that.
Yeah.
That is weird. So, cool stuff about that speech center. So, now you can go home and like, talk to your family and see, you know what hand they write with, see what side of their brain is that speech center housed on. Most of us left side. Back in the, I want to say 1850s or so, really wicked accident happened with this man. You may have heard of him in a speech class. And what happened was he was working around railroads and there was an explosion and that rod blew through his brain. So nowadays, of course, We have ways to deal with that. It's amazing that he lived at all back then. So they did extract that pipe from his head. And, of course, it wasn't the speech center that pipe went through, but you can see it went through the front of his brain right there. So do you know what happened to his personality after that pipe blew through his head? You think he was the same kind, caring, loving person? He was mad. Yep. So not just mad that he had a pipe in his head, but, mad because he had brain damage to a certain area. And that certain area is this. It's called the prefrontal cortex, and it actually damaged that part of his brain. Certainly it did. Look at that hole, right? Left blind in that eye. But damage to the prefrontal cortex is damaging the personality part of our brain. So we now understand why he had those changes in that part of the brain. We house personality, we house decorum, we house, when to say something, when not to say something to people in that frontal cortex, that prefrontal cortex of the brain. So interesting that that accident back 150 some years ago actually gave us a clue about what that part of the brain is responsible for. So on your sheet there, you'll notice that it is a personality area, decorum, toilet training, that kind of thing. Have you heard of lobotomies?
Yes.
Okay, so prefrontal lobotomies were a thing back in the 1940s to the 1960s. And do you know who they treated with prefrontal lobotomies? Yeah, people depressed, schizophrenics. Yeah, people who had habits that maybe they didn't socially think were acceptable. Worse yet, people who had teenagers that they thought were unruly were brought in for these lobotomies. What's that?
Trying to make them docile.
Trying to make them docile. Well, they did their job, right? So if you have a prefrontal lobotomy, you have that part of your brain damaged. They actually stuck these rods up through the orbits of the eye, chopsticks, yeah, and just jabbed into that area. Not very smart, because we know that's where, yeah. Rosemary Kennedy had it done back in the 1950s. She had bipolar disorder and unfortunately made her into a vegetable. And so that condition we know of having your prefrontal lobe damaged leads to sometimes people who no longer have toilet training as part of their routine, they don't have decorum, they speak and say what they feel like saying, and unfortunately that may lead to a very different life from the one that they were meant to have led. So in the 1960s they finally stopped doing these prefrontal lobotomies. We now know that a lot of the things they were trying to treat were medically treatable through medications. So unfortunate situation there, but it does teach us what that prefrontal lobe is responsible for. All right, very bottom of your page, hemispheric lateralization. So there are two cerebral hemispheres, and each hemisphere seems to have certain key features that makes it more specialized than the other one. The left hemisphere, for instance, seems to control math and language, logic, and the right hemisphere tends to control more visual and spatial issues, emotion, and artistic skills. So, you know, we've oftentimes said that people who are math and science oriented are more left brain, and those who prefer for more of arts and things of that sort are more right brain. In reality, you're not using just one hemisphere. You may rely on one more than the other, but you're using both simultaneously to perform your jobs. So interesting stuff there. Okay, so now that we've got all those brain parts taken care of, going back to your picture, do you have any questions about your picture? So let me take you over to page 117. This one is the one titled Brain. First word on the top is cerebellum. Because there's a lot to remember in this particular part of the chapter, I did boldface some terms for y'all. Notice under cerebellum, the boldface term is muscle coordination. That's what I would remember about it. We know it's the back part of your brain. It is a special piece of brain tissue that helps us to coordinate our muscle movements. In fact, it has its own homunculus, this scary looking little dude, and that is a map of how our body parts are imaged onto that cerebellum. And again, this time we're looking at the gross motor movements, things like your hands and feet, those larger motor skills, not the fine tune that we see for, you know, that part of your brain that we just discussed. So this cerebellum is pretty small in human beings, but in an animal like a bird, the cerebellum is actually much larger than the cerebrum, because coordination of flying requires much more cerebellar brain space than does just processing thoughts. So we actually have a fairly small cerebellum. Let's see, the diencephalon is next. It includes three main regions: thalamus, hypothalamus, and then the pituitary gland. If I had to remember one word about your hypothalamus, I would remember it's responsible for homeostasis. Now, there's more to it than that. So in this picture, let me show you where the hypothalamus is located, and you're going to have to kind of play along with the imagination here. This piece right along here is called the corpus callosum. That corpus callosum is actually those fibers that connect left and right hemispheres. What were those fibers called? Commissural fibers, yes. So that's a piece that connects left and right hemispheres. I look for that, and then I come inside, and there's like a region here, looks like a duck's beak sticking down. It looks like a duck's throat. There's the duck's breast or chest sticking out, and it looks like the duck has a backpack on. Okay? Do you see it? Okay. I'm not crazy, right? All right, so right in here, that's the thalamus. Okay? And then right beneath it, I'm heading down toward that duck's beak. Below is hypothalamus. So what I do is I look for this crest, this corpus callosum. I come inside. It looks like a duck's eye. That's my thalamus. Right underneath is my hypothalamus. And they have cut off the pituitary, but it would have been hanging from down here from that infundibulum. All right, so hypothalamus is actually home to a major set of homeostatic control mechanisms. If you'll notice your list there, everything from autonomic nervous system, we haven't talked about that one yet, but your emotional response, body temperature control, hunger, thirst, those things are all housed here in the hypothalamus. Endocrine system's a biggie. That's going to be our BIO-211 opening discussion. So this is a majorly important part of your brain. It is kind of our homeostasis control center. And you'll notice here that body temperature control is one of our functions. Some drugs, like ecstasy, can actually increase our preset norm. Most of us are set somewhere around 98 degrees, but this drug can preset you up to 103, 104, 105. You will die at 108. So it cooks you, literally makes your proteins denature. So people who take this may experience hot flashes, and they may be permanent, because if your hypothalamus gets reset to a different temperature, then that becomes your norm. That's kind of unfortunate if it's set up as high as 108. We'll talk more about endocrine. That is a big thing for BIO-211, but nonetheless, the hypothalamus and pituitary have a very tight relationship. In fact, your hypothalamus controls a lot of your endocrine glands through hormones. So we'll talk more about that in the next class. Going back to our picture, the thalamus is this piece right here. It kind of looks like the eye. We already know it receives incoming sensory information from a spinothalamic pathway. What type of info? Pain and temperature, good. So it comes up the spinal cord, heads to the thalamus, and the thalamus will then relay that information out to the right sensory area of your brain. Not only is pain and temperature routed through here, but so is your vision, your hearing, taste, just not smell. Smell is not hardwired through the thalamus region, but everything else is routed through the thalamus onto the appropriate area of your brain. So I bolded the term relay station for sensory info. That's what it does, is it takes pain, temperature, vision, hearing, taste, not smell, but it relays those senses out to the right parts of your brain. There's other features of the thalamus you may read on and notice that sleep and wake cycles are regulated here. So there's certainly more to these brain parts than what we're focusing on. So just for fun, here we go. We've got these ascending tracks coming up through those lateral columns. That pain or temperature information may stop by your thalamus, and then it's relayed off to the correct portion of your sensory cortex. Is that sensory cortex in your parietal lobe or your frontal lobe? Parietal. Yeah, that sensory cortex is in your parietal lobe. So this is a sensory pathway that we're looking at. That's how that thalamus is involved as a relay station in that particular pathway. And then just for the last one here, pituitary gland hangs from your hypothalamus. This again is a major 211 topic, and we talk about how those two work together to really run the show in terms of your hormones. So we'll come back and talk about that in 211. How about questions on the diencephalon, thalamus, hypothalamus, pituitary? Remember those bold-faced terms. Brainstem includes three main regions, pons, medulla oblongata, and midbrain. All right, so hypothalamus and medulla, you might recall, do not have a blood-brain barrier. Okay, so when we talk about the medulla, you may read the list there of centers, and you've got cardiovascular center, a respiratory center, a vomiting center, and a vasomotor center that are housed in this particular piece of brain tissue. So because there is no blood-brain barrier, this piece of brain tissue has direct access to your blood, which is good. What if you've got, say, some bacteria from some food you ate? You'll vomit as a response. What if you don't vomit out that food? Stays
sicker longer.
Yep, could be dead, right? So unfortunately, you know, we don't enjoy vomiting, but it's a way to get the poison out of our bodies before it becomes further contaminated. So let's look for the medulla. Let's see, in this picture, that's not a good one. Let's go back to another one. In this picture, you'll notice the thalamus here, right beneath it is hypothalamus. Pituitary would have been hanging from that infundibulum. That takes care of that diencephalon. And then over here, we've got this very recognizable pons, and right near the pons is going to be that medulla oblongata. Let me see if I can find you a better image of that. Yeah, this one's probably about the best one for it. Okay, so you may recognize top piece is the thalamus. That piece that sticks out here, that bulge is the pons. Right below that is the medulla oblongata. And notice as you drop down further, now you've entered the spinal cord. So in this previous picture, we actually couldn't even see it because it would be about right down here in this lower portion of the below the pons area. So speaking of the pons, notice one of its main functions is to regulate breathing. In fact, if you go to sleep at night, you don't have to worry about breathing because the pons does help to turn off and turn on your breathing rhythms. So it is an involuntary portion that helps to control the rhythm of your breathing. And then finally, the midbrain sits behind the pons, right back here. There's four little bumps back here. They're called the midbrain. Okay, they're right in there. And on this picture, let's look at them as well. There they are. They're called the corpora quadrigemina. Those four little bumps right there make the midbrain. And that midbrain is actually where we house some of our reflexes. So, obviously you ride in cars, right? Okay, if you go over a bump, your eyes can still stay steady on the road, right? Okay, and if you don't, if you're riding on a really bumpy road, your eyes are bouncing with the road and you start to feel sick. Same thing happens in a boat, right? Your eyes may be bouncing up and down with the boat and the horizon's moving for you and your inner ear balance is trying to keep up with what your eyes are doing. So if those reflexes kind of get off and not very well coordinated, then that midbrain there may induce us to be sick, right? Because there's seasickness or car sickness that comes. So the reflexes that are actually coordinations between your eyes and your ears. Another thing that happens in this midbrain area is if you turn your head and your eyes are tracking and spotting, they're actually tracking and spotting together. Of course, they're not moving apart, right? If you spin around, you can track a room by keeping your eyes focused on one area. Those kinds of reflexes that make our eyes track together is also housed through that midbrain. So it's mostly what we consider to be a reflex center. And then you'll notice the RAS is actually housed through there. We'll talk about that one on the next page. There is a lot of info that we have covered so far. That brain picture is pretty hefty. All those parts of the cerebrum, that's a lot of info. This page is a pretty hefty page. What I would recommend doing is redrawing out a brain like we just did in class earlier, relabeling it, and this time go through and put down what the function is too. And then this page here, like I mentioned, I would focus on those bold-faced functions. That'll help keep you focused. Instead of getting into the info on page 118, that is actually the last of the brain info. I think I'll save that for our opening on Tuesday. Let me share with you where we're heading on Tuesday. We're heading into the autonomic nervous system. It is a short chapter, but it is a punch of info again. So we will actually repeat that stuff on Thursday of next week. So I'm not going to just hit it once and be done. We'll come back to it. But your test for the 19th will run, let's see where we got, page 126. Okay, so if you want to work a little ahead, test number 4 will run up to page 126.